disability, sexuality, and reproductive rights. We have three people to present this morning. Leslie Francis, who is a distinguished Alfred C. Emery Professor of Law and a distinguished professor of philosophy and director of the University of Utah Center for Law and Biomedical Sciences of the University of Utah. And we have Jasmine Harris, who is acting professor of law at the University of California, Davis. And we have Kimberly Mutcherson. I didn't ask her how to pronounce it, but I hope I got it.
That was perfect.
Vice Dean and Professor of Law at Rutgers Law School. And they tell me that they would like the order in reverse order that they're shown in the program and reverse order of their introduction. So why don't we begin then with Kimberly?
Terrific.
Welcome to the law symposium.
Thank you so much. I'm going to start my timer. Yes, I do. I'm going to start my timer because I want to make sure that I don't steal more time than I have a right to. And first, I just want to start by saying thanks so much for having me here. This is my first time at the Tenbrook, and it's pretty amazing. And I'm especially grateful to be here because I feel like a little bit of an interloper, and I'll tell you why I think that. So while my work definitely incorporates issues of disability, those issues aren't necessarily the focal point of everything that I do. So that being said, let me situate my scholarly work just a little bit so that you can make some sense of why I'm here talking to you this morning. So my work sits at the intersection of health law, bioethics, and family law. I am broadly interested in how the law regulates families and procreation, and how it does so in ways that reinforce reproductive hierarchies and reproductive oppression. So let me explain those terms as I use them and as others who do the work that I do use them. So reproductive hierarchies basically refers to the way that reproduction has been and continues to be used to make to mark some bodies as worthwhile and others as not worthwhile. So in other words, who are the people who deserve to have babies and who are the people who do not? Which are the bodies that deserve to be replicated and which are the bodies that don't? In terms of reproductive oppression, that refers to the numerous ways in which people, especially women, but not only women, are subjected to discriminatory treatment on the basis of pregnancy, capacity for pregnancy, refusal or lack of desire for pregnancy, or parenting. So within that framework, most of my work over the last decade or so has focused on assisted reproduction and the fertility industry. And in fact, I've specifically written about discrimination in access to assisted reproduction on the basis of disability, hence my invitation to speak to you folks today. My time is relatively short, so please feel free to ask me clarifying questions in the Q&A because I'm going to go relatively quickly and I'm going to assume a basic level of understanding about the fertility industry. I usually describe it as a sort of New York Times level of knowledge about this business, and it is very much a business. Fair warning also that I'm going to raise lots of issues for which I don't have answers, so maybe some of you all will have them in the Q&A. And also, unfortunately, I'm going to have to run right after the panel ends because I have to be back at my law school in New Jersey by 12:30 today. But I'm the only Mutcherson at Rutgers Law. In fact, I think I'm the only Mutcherson in all of New Jersey. So I'm very easy to find if you want to find me afterwards. So let me go ahead and get started. First, by talking about assisted reproduction and the right to procreate in general. So as we all know, we have a constitutionally protected fundamental right to procreate that hasn't specifically been extended to assisted reproduction by the Supreme Court, but there are lots and lots of great arguments for why it should be extended, which I don't have time to present here, so I'm just going to ask you to please believe me on this one. The court has also, of course, declared parenting to be a fundamental right. And we all know that the Supreme Court hasn't articulated that many fundamental rights that don't explicitly appear in the text of the Constitution. So the fact that parenting and procreation are two of them, I think, is really significant. That these are things that matter, that they are literally the stuff of life, and for many people, being able to procreate and parent are real cornerstones of a life well lived. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that procreation and parenting are, in fact, necessary to having a good life, only that many people seem to think so and live their lives accordingly. And in part, we know how important parenting and procreation are because we've seen in the past and frankly continue to see in the present, and I will expect to see for the foreseeable future, how procreation and parenting have been used to mark acceptable people and citizens from unacceptable people and citizens. So things like state-sanctioned sterilization abuse of all sorts of groups, including people with disabilities, women of color, low-income folks, long history of eugenics in this country and frankly around the globe. So thinking of a case like Buck versus Bell, the Supreme Court case in which the court decided that, quote, three generations of imbeciles are enough, has to be up there with some of the most disturbing lines ever to appear in a U.S. Supreme Court opinion. And of course, Buck versus Bell technically still hasn't been overturned. And then thinking about things like the unwarranted removal of children from homes where parents were deemed unfit for reasons that lots of us would think do not, in fact, make them unfit to parent. So these are important rights, but they are, of course, negative rights because that's the way that our Constitution functions. So they're always focused on what the government can't do to us as opposed to what the government might owe us. So that a right is important, that it's critical, that it's life-affirming, doesn't mean that we have a positive right to access it, and certainly not that we have a right to ask the government to help us access it. But I've been puzzling through what it would mean if, in fact, that wasn't the case, if we could, in fact, make the government think of our right to procreate and our right to parent as a positive right. Now, I should, of course, say that in the world that we live in now, this is never going to happen. So we're in a little bit of a fantasy space here, but I'm okay with that because sometimes that's what keeps you going in life. So let me talk about a positive right to procreate. Now, my starting premise here is that the fertility industry is, I got three E's here, elitist, expensive, and exploitative in various ways. And I say that as someone who doesn't demonize this industry in general. I think it's important. I think that it has been incredibly meaningful for lots and lots of people, including myself. That's where my two kids came from. But there are lots of ways in which it's a problematic industry. So one of those is certainly cost. Some treatments can be relatively cheap and can even be done without the assistance of a physician or other healthcare providers, such as artificial insemination, but others can be prohibitively expensive. So in vitro fertilization, which can cost anywhere from $9,000 to $15,000 per cycle, buying eggs or buying sperm, doing a gestational surrogacy arrangement, which could cost as much as $100,000. Lots of us simply don't have the money in our bank accounts to be able to pay for such things. So some people live in states that require some amount of insurance access. For instance, Illinois and New Jersey require that. But even those states can be restrictive. So things like you can only be, you have to be below a certain age in order to get access, the number of cycles that insurance will pay for, that you have to prove that you're medically infertile before you're able to use your insurance for these purposes. And I use the term medical infertility to contrast with social infertility. So medical infertility basically means a person who has sex with a person of the opposite sex for a period of at least a year and doesn't get pregnant. If you're over the age of 35, which I was with my second child, which therefore meant I had what's called a geriatric pregnancy, which makes you feel great when that's when you're being referred to that way. So if you're over the age of 65, if you don't get pregnant within 6 months, then we have concerns about your ability to get pregnant. So that's medical infertility. Social infertility refers to folks who perhaps could get pregnant, but who don't do so for other reasons. So same-sex couples, people who are single, people who desire to avoid particular diseases, those people might also use assisted reproduction. And of course, insurance mandates only matter if you have private insurance. And we know that there are higher rates of medical infertility among certain populations, including women of color. We know that there are certain populations that will have more social infertility. And those people can really get locked out of the market, both because of price, but also, frankly, because of lots of private discrimination. And people with disabilities might experience many of the same barriers. In particular, healthcare providers, fertility providers, who make assumptions about who's going to be a good parent or who is capable of being a good parent, or fertility providers, frankly, who are uncomfortable working with certain bodies that they haven't had to work with before. And if all we have is a negative right, that's really not going to help us get to where we need to go. Furthermore, we're partially sending a message that procreation only matters deeply to those who can access it without assistance, which frankly is the same message sent by other programs that targeted the procreation of folks who we thought of, or who the state thought of, as undesirable. So the lack of a positive right, coupled with the fact that people can get access to other sorts of services, especially with public insurance, including consensual sterilization or long-acting birth control, also sort of sends a message, right? We'll pay for you to not have babies, but we definitely don't want to pay for you to have babies, because you're not the type who should have babies. So if we thought about a positive right to procreate, there are some things that I think would exist, hopefully, in such a regime. So one, that not only would states and maybe private actors who receive state funding be forbidden from engaging in invidious discrimination in access to assisted reproduction, but the state would actually have programs to provide access to those who would not or could not otherwise avail themselves, especially because of income. So I wholly reject the idea of, if you don't have enough money to pay for this kind of care, then you shouldn't be having babies in the first instance, because frankly, not having $100,000 in the bank that you just have on hand to spend on IVF or other sorts of treatments doesn't mean that you are incapable of being a good parent. Needing some type of social or other support, either to get pregnant or to care for a child, doesn't mean that you are not going to be a good parent, or at least an adequate parent, which is really what the law requires, frankly. So procreation is not simply a perk for the elite. If it matters, it matters for all of us. We'd also want more insurance mandates so that private insurance would cover this kind of care, and without some of the existing restrictions that can discriminate. So for instance, you have to be medically infertile, which means people with social infertility don't necessarily have access. I would, of course, want a world in which we had comprehensive family leave policies so that women in particular can engage in childbearing at younger ages if they so choose and not sacrifice their ability to build careers. And certainly I would want to see better social supports for those who might need various kinds of assistance to make sure that they can have healthy pregnancies and safe deliveries in the first instance and then be able to parent their children. Now, I want to end by thinking about some of the things that are problematic about opening up access to assisted reproduction to more folks, and even asking the government to assist people in that access. One of those things, so on the sort of theoretical side, is the idea that it kind of buys into this mommy imperative, right? That women should feel all of this pressure to be mothers because that's really what women are here for, and that women should be central, that pregnancy should be central in women's lives. True for some people, deeply untrue for others. And I don't think that we want to reinstantiate that idea of what women are and what women should be. On the more practical side, in the context of assisted reproduction, we should always be worried about commodification and exploitation. So commodification of babies and bodies, and the worry that we turn babies into products when they get produced as part of a $1 billion industry. And at this point, the fertility industry is in fact a $1 billion industry. And the commodification and exploitation of women and women's bodies, who are often sellers in these markets, either of their eggs or of their reproductive capacity if they act as surrogates. So the upshot is that a positive right to procreate doesn't mean that people should have access to the bodies of women who suffer. And let me just be clear about what I mean by that. It's inevitable that in a business that creates human beings, there are going to be minefields. And I'll just talk about one, and I'm going to focus on surrogacy as a form of troubling, I think, reproductive labor. One, it's impossible to price a service like this, right? How much would you be willing to be paid to carry a baby for somebody else? It's a form of body work that's different from any other type of body work that somebody could engage in. It potentially treats women as vessels and as a means to an end rather than as whole persons. Certainly, we have the risk that it treats babies as commodities and products in a market, which a lot of us think is problematic, that it cheapens reproduction, and that it preys on women who are less powerful in order to serve the needs and desires of women and men who have other types of power. But of course, there are also the ways in which surrogacy and other types of assisted reproduction help people create families that I refer to as sort of marginalized families, right? The kinds of families that for a long time people were not able to create at all. So for instance, if you were a woman without a uterus, it was very hard, obviously, and impossible to get pregnant. Same-sex couples who weren't able to have babies and bring them into their families. So it raises the issue of how we understand and dismantle hierarchies of reproduction and reproductive oppression, in which the positioning in those hierarchies can really shift and is subject to various kinds of interpretation. So what that means in practice and what it means for how to actuate a positive right to procreate is certainly much harder to say. And even if commodification is inevitable in this industry, and I think it sort of is, we should think deeply about how to build an industry that doesn't exploit, which frankly I'm not sure is possible. And if exploitation is the measure of whether an industry can exist, then frankly there are hundreds of industries that we're going to have to shut down very soon. So I promised you that I would raise some tough issues without giving solutions, and that is exactly my plan. I have no solutions for any of this. So I'm going to leave you with just a few thoughts. My biggest concern about a positive right to procreate is that it would require legislative action or regulation of some sort, almost certainly. And I think we always want to be cautious about that, because asking for regulation, frankly, is a leap of faith, because ultimately we don't always control what that legislation looks like. For instance, we might want a world in which women have access to safe and legal abortion, and we can regulate that, but in seeking that, we also end up with regulation that seeks to make access to abortion procedures difficult, if not impossible, especially for poor women. So for instance, we might want regulation that ensures access to assisted reproduction for people with disabilities, but end up with legislation that imbues prejudice into the process of family making by creating parenting standards. I'm almost done. Parenting standards that are to the detriment of certain communities, and we've seen this already. So in the end, I think that assisted reproduction provides this incredibly fruitful space for thinking about procreation as a public good. But the fact that assisted reproduction is a space in which people, legislators and other policymakers, can seek to control procreation without having to also make attempts to control sex makes this industry a place where folks can play out some of their most egregious eugenic fantasies about whose genes should prosper and whose genes should wither. And frankly, we all know too well where that path leads. Thank you.
So, Jasmine Harris, you're up.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Maurer. So I wanna start by just extending another note of thanks to the steering committee, and in particular, Lou Ann Blake, and I'd like to give her a round of applause for all of her work. And thank you to all of you for being here, and I wanna also thank Leslie and Kim for engaging in this topic. I have to say I'm really excited to hear from practitioners, and so like Kim, I'm going to, and as Dr. Maurer said yesterday, I'm going to be a dreamer for a while and not leave you with solutions necessarily, but engaging difficult questions. And so I'm really excited to hear from practitioners, and I love this conference because of the opportunity to exchange ideas between practitioners and academics who are thinking, again, the dreamers and the doers, as Dr. Maurer says. This allows us to really be connected in both arenas. I haven't seen a conference like this. I think maybe the closest one that might come to this would be the Lavender Law Conference, and it's much bigger and less intimate. And so I have to say that this is my favorite conference by far, and I look forward to it every year. So I also want to take one quick moment and recognize what today is. Today is Cesar Chavez Day, and it's an appropriate day to coincide with the Tenbrook Conference. We talked about intersectionality yesterday. We talked about the importance of thinking about movement building and messaging from the ground up, and quite frankly, thinking about how to change social norms and public attitudes about equality. And Cesar Chavez, both with and for farm workers, was able to do that, change perceptions about wages and working conditions. And there's also the connection with disability, particularly the use of pesticides and the creation of disability through these work conditions itself. So I do think it's an appropriate note to realize today and to think about intersectionality as we move forward. So I want to situate this presentation within the conference themes thus far. This has been a very thematic conference, as many people have commented. So what are the main themes? The first is that we're trying to figure out collectively, how do we give meaning to equal protection and constitutional principles of equal protection under the law? And how do we message these issues in courts and think about the movement itself. The second major theme is the importance of courts as sites for shifts in social norms and equality of social norms of equality and disability. Now, we don't traditionally think of courts as very progressive sites of social normative change. But this conference, again, we're hearing time and time again that judges are integral in starting to amend our conceptions of what constitutional principles are, particularly as they refer to people with disabilities. Third, the need for data, creating a record. Yesterday we had folks talk about the need for documenting history and the history of past discrimination, and the need for cultural change more broadly. So I want to shift the conversation a bit. Today, our title is, of course, Sexuality, Reproduction, and Reproductive Rights, and I get to talk about sex. So this is supposed to be fun. I need to hear, you know, this is the fun part. We get to talk about sex. Why sex? So I want to shift to this conversation of sex and disability and tell you a little bit about why sex, why am I interested in this area of scholarship, and also tell you about a particular group of individuals within the disability rights movement that I'm focused on. So first, I want to start by saying that sex, as many people have talked about in other contexts, is the final frontier in many respects. Family law and sex is an area that we have not permeated in the way that we have in employment and other civil rights arenas. And Ann Finger, who is a disability rights advocate and a scholar, has made the following remark: sexuality is often the source of our deepest oppression. It is also often the source of our deepest pain. It's easier for us to talk about and formulate strategies for changing discrimination in employment, education, and housing than to talk about our exclusion from sexuality and reproduction. Ann Finger said this in 1992, and sadly, we are in the same position today. So we do have quite a bit to talk about. So the second, why am I interested in sex, and in particular, who is the target audience or group or interest group here? It's people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Why? Because for this group, there are the constant carve-outs. You even see this in Lawrence v. Texas, at least how it's been read by courts, that people who cannot consent to sex, therefore, are somehow outside of the realm of applicability of Lawrence v. Texas. And at the end of the presentation, I'll talk a little bit about how we might see that differently by looking at Lawrence v. Texas. So you see the carve-outs like people with mild intellectual disability can have sex, or people with intellectual disabilities can have sex with each other, but it becomes problematic when one of those people does not have an intellectual disability. That's when things get complicated. So I'm hoping to start a conversation and to leave the room here, leave lots of room here for during the Q&A for discussion. And I'd like to invite you all to continue this discussion in the workshop that follows with Sam Crane and Victoria Rodriguez Roldan, and with Natalie Chin. They're going to be talking about these issues as well, so we can continue the conversation. Okay, so similar to other presenters, I want to structure our discussion by answering or suggesting answers to two questions, and then, as Kim has done, posing a bunch of questions to you without clear answers, right? So this is the fun, this is the fun part of being an academic. Okay, so the first question, using Ann Finger's comment as a jumping off point, what makes sex so difficult, sex and disability so difficult to talk about? Well, one, it makes it hard because we don't have in society more broadly an organizing principle for the value of sex and sexuality for non-disabled people. So how are we going to understand the normative baseline when we have no conception of what that baseline exists more broadly? You see folks in feminist legal theory, you see other folks who are struggling within the rape sexual assault scholarship trying to think about what is the organizing principle about sex and consent. What do we care about in this area? Secondly, there's a significant information deficit in this area. Misinformation and circulation. So what happens? Most of the public does not understand and maybe has not even had contact with a person with an intellectual or developmental disability, yet alone have the wherewithal and understanding to see their capabilities more broadly. So where do they get their information from as a default? From journalistic reports and the media, and we know how good that actually does us. And even though we have speechless now, and we can look past Life Goes On, I think we still have some work to do in terms of J.J. DeMeo, the main character, not being all things to all people. And for those of you who have not seen Speechless, please go ahead and then we can talk about it. The other question of what makes sex and mental disability so hard to talk about, well, because the fundamental question in the context of people with mental disabilities is that question of legal capacity. It's forcing us to confront these assumptions and presumptions head on. And these are really difficult questions. Who's entitled to have sex? When do we worry? Are there indicia of incapacity? These are all really tough questions. The other reason I want to suggest that makes mental disability and sex so difficult to talk about is that courts have, in particular to courts have not been successful in doing what we all understand to be the disaggregation of legal capacity. What do I mean by the disaggregation of legal capacity? What I mean by that is that legal capacity as a concept with respect to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities has always been this categorical presumption of incapacity. So it coincided with the development of the institutionalization, and then deinstitutionalization came, where services were disaggregated, and suddenly the government, the state, had to figure out, how are we going to disaggregate services, and how are we going to disaggregate these questions of decision making? And courts, not surprisingly, courts have been really slow to come on board here. And so intellectually, they may understand that legal capacity is a complex concept, it is context specific. They may get all of those buzzwords over time, but the difficulty, again, is an application. And what does that mean for what courts have to do, the difficult decisions that they might have to make in the context of reproduction, probate court, or where an unlikely place where you see conceptions of sexuality, which is in rape and sexual assault cases, where you have either a defendant with an intellectual disability, or you have a target or a survivor with an intellectual disability. So these are the unlikely sites where you're seeing courts struggle with the concept of sexuality and disability. The other reason I want to suggest why this is so difficult, yesterday we talked about why is it so difficult for judges to understand? Why is it so difficult for courts to understand this concept? How can we get courts to understand that sex is both appropriate, possible, and something that people actually want in many instances and should be supported, not oppressed? How do we get courts to see that capacity as a legal concept should be disaggregated? So the question we should be asking in these cases is, did the person consent? Did the person have the capacity to consent? And what does that mean as a practical matter? Did they have the ability to understand the knowledge? Did they have the knowledge and ability to understand the nature and consequences of their actions in making the decision about sex? It's a very narrow inquiry, despite what courts may have done with this standard. And so the challenge for all of us is, how do we then, as advocates, get courts to understand, one, that it's a narrow standard, and two, that this is a question that is quite nuanced. And again, as I said before, the law, we all know how well the law does with nuance. So it's not going to be easy. So what are people afraid of when we talk about sex? Abuse. Inherent vulnerability. Disgust. If you're Martha Nussbaum, you're scared of disgust. And these are all important conceptions. These are all real fears. But there's also something that we haven't been talking about, which is what on balance, what's the countervailing right? Is there a fundamental right to have sex? No. Okay, that's really dreaming. We're really dreaming there. But what are the possible conceptions of what the stakes are? Well, one, the stakes are risk. We as a disability rights community have constantly talked about what's called the dignity of risk, right? Robert Persky's conception of that it's dignified. What's dignified about risk is that risk is part of the normalization process, that you actually learn over time through the process of taking risks, right? And so to shield people with IDDD from all risk and to have zero risk as your goal is really problematic, particularly in the arena of sexual expression and sexual rights. But the problem, again, is these historical conceptions of asexuality or hypersexuality that are highly gendered and class-based. So on this concept of risk, I've been thinking about this quite a bit. Jeff Rutlinski at Cornell, he's studied this concept of judges really trying to, over time, he's looked at it over time and said, judges are trying to get to zero risk. And so that's in all areas. And in particular, it explains some of the risk aversion in the area of sexual expression. So I want to kind of, hopefully I've done a fairly good job of explaining what makes sex and mental disability so hard to talk about, or at least suggesting some ideas, right? And so the second question that we talked about yesterday in terms of structure is, when courts talk about sexuality and mental disability, what do they say? So we talked about how Justice Kennedy has quite a bit to say about other topics, about constitutional principles, but what do courts say about sexuality and mental disability? Well, again, the sites, where do we look to find this information? We look to sexual assault and rape cases. That's one place. We look to probate. We look to reproductive rights cases. There are many locations where we can see it. The important part is to actually look deeply and see what are the narratives of legal capacity to consent that are in those cases. So this is really where my current project lives. I am interested in thinking about the ways in which rules, either evidentiary rules or procedural rules, how they can be used and manipulated to shape social norms. And here I'm thinking about the social norms around sexuality and sexual expression for people with IDDD. And what I've done is I've done a significant data collection to understand, in an unlikely area in rape and sexual assault cases, what are courts saying about the sexuality of people with IDDD? We understand the stakes, but what are the narratives? And so I don't have time to go into in detail some of the findings, and I'm happy to do that with folks afterwards. But I will say that one of the benefits of doing this is to understand, as an evidentiary matter, we know that the legal standard is knowledge of nature and consequences, right? I've suggested that this is a narrow standard. The really interesting question is, what does this look like on the ground? What evidence are courts using to prove legal capacity and legal incapacity, rather? The evidence is really a window into how these proceedings are playing out and what the narratives are. And so some of the really interesting things that I found by looking at a data set of 228 appellate rape and sexual assault cases is to really see some of the narratives unfolding. The first thing is one of the main sources of evidence, this is not going to be surprising to most folks here, again, proving that someone lacks the capacity to consent to sex is their IQ or their mental age, which we all know is problematic as a historical matter for various reasons, class-based, gender-based, race-based. This has been used as a tool of oppression, as Kim says, over time. Another interesting finding to share is that we would think that people with disabilities are not, with intellectual disabilities, are not taking the stand. they're not actually engaged in testifying. And in fact, in 97% of the cases that I looked at, they are taking the stand. So the question is, how are juries, who are the primary fact finders here, receiving them? Are they judging them on the basis of their physical appearance, sensory, auditory? What are those factors? So the study will reveal some of the other points of evidence that people are using. But what I want to suggest is that the legal process is flawed more broadly, right? So taking on the criminal justice system is not something I want to do. What I really want to do is I want to suggest that there's something happening in terms of the way courts understand sexuality. And the way to get at it, or one way that has been underexplored, is by looking at these rape and sexual assault cases, that they tell us something. And what they tell us is, well, again, it's not positive. They're telling us that there are factors such as, and this is one of the most ridiculous items of evidence that was the key piece of evidence in a case to show improving capacity, that the woman could not independently take a bus. She could not independently take a bus or public transportation, and therefore, clearly she lacks the life skills to engage in sex. Well, I know a lot of people who don't know public transportation, let's say in New York, and they are clearly engaging in sex. So we have to really push here and think about what is the connection between mental impairment and what is the connection between this legal standard. And so I want to suggest that this is an area that's underexplored and that it does have lessons for what we understand and what courts understand about sexuality and intellectual disability. I have 2 minutes remaining. So I want to move on to the two areas where I leave you with questions, as Kim correctly did. And the first is, okay, so then what do we want in this area? What would meaningful equal protection look like in the area of sex and mental disability? What would that look like? Well, I'm sure that this is something we're going to discuss in the workshop, one of the workshops that follows, but I would leave you with some questions here. One is, what is the proper site or forum for regulation of sexual agency? Clearly, criminal law is not working overall. Criminal law has a particular goal, that is to protect. That is not a great site of regulating sexual agency. So what is a good way? We're thinking about it ex post in courts, or we should be thinking about it ex ante in terms of perhaps hearings ahead of time, probate proceedings, creation of indicia of incapacity, as I suggest, evidentiary incapacity. So that's one question. But I do think that my research is opening up this avenue again and thinking about what does the evidence in these cases tell us about the ways in which sexuality is constructed in courts. The second question to leave you all with is, okay, so then how do we strategize as an advocacy community to get there, right? So we talked about, Sam Bagenstos talked about how we theorize so that we can get to concrete goals. So again, I think so this is something we might talk about later, but in terms of cases, what would this look like ex post? The low-hanging fruit, and this was suggested yesterday, is to think about these issues of sexuality broadly and to think about where do constructions of sexuality happen? Family law is an area that's underexplored. So yesterday, Michael Waterstone suggested we should go ahead and we should file equal protection claims and take out the questions around parental termination, the clear fundamental rights, parental termination, reproduction, though that's the low-hanging fruit here, right? The danger, as Kim suggested, in the context of assisted reproductive technology, is that you're reinforcing particular norms when you go after and construct those cases, as in the gay marriage context, that you're, again, you're privileging marriage over other forms What I'd like to see happen is we're not privileging relationships between people with intellectual disabilities alone or privileging sex in those committed relationships, but they can have casual sex just like everyone else. And they can make the same types of mistakes that other people get to make. Okay, and so just two additional points. Again, how do we organize as a community? What are some ideas? Like academics, as academics, again, I want to reiterate the potential for us to publish law review articles that people read and courts use. Yeah, I know it sounds like a foreign concept here, but again, can we generate scholarship that supports what you're doing on the ground? So that's something that I think we can, in fact, do. And empirical projects is one way for us to actually do that, is to study what courts are doing. We have the resources to do it, and so I've very much enjoyed engaging in these projects and will continue to do so. Policy folks, so data. So I think what we agreed upon yesterday is that one of these wonderful universities is going to fund and found an institute on data collection. Right? So I didn't say Davis would. So let's be very clear that Davis is not going to do that as of this moment, public institution. Maybe some of you private institutions out there, that's all I'll say. Okay. But the idea of tracking these data gaps, we need to understand what's happening on the ground, what's happening in guardianship cases, what's happening behind closed doors. And some of this is happening. In New York, I know Chris Glenn has organized a particular commission to really track some of the data, but we need to do this more systematically. Okay, and then other interventions outside of the judicial system, and then I will leave you with that. Think about ex ante. What is the possible intervention? Well, if we're waiting till ex post to address this, it's a problem. Sex ed, as a practical matter, one of the things that on the ground as a lawyer that I saw is that in the special education context, IEPs did not contain any plan for sex education for students who were in the age of transition. So we're talking about 14 on. That's a real problem. And so there are ways in which we can, as advocates, tackle these questions of sexuality and teeing up and allowing people to have the knowledge of the nature and consequences of sex. How do we get that? So before we even get into courts, I think there's work to be done, and I really look forward to your questions, and thank you so much.
So, and Leslie Francis is our third presenter.
So, like everyone else, I really need to express my very heartfelt thanks for the privilege of being here as an academic and for the wonderful way that this conference brings amazingly different perspectives together. What I might add from my own perspective is that I'm a lawyer and I'm also a philosopher who has spent a lot of time working on issues in bioethics. And so there's going to be a little bit of bioethics from my perspective. So like both Kim and Jasmine, I want to situate this in the context of the conference themes. First, the basic right to have and to bear children. I'll go back to Dr. Maurer's comment yesterday about the recognition of this in the writings of Jacobus ten Broek, after whom this conference is named. I'll also locate it in the shadow of Buck v. Bell, which, as we all know, has never been formally overruled. And in all the concerns about the extent to which states still may challenge people with disabilities as parents, I'm going to frame this as anti-discrimination, though, not as a flat out right for the provision of the means needed to reproduce. And I want to look at it again as practically as I can. The practical perspective that I bring to this from a bioethics world a little bit is I've been involved on a lot of ethics committees. Most recently, I'm a member of the Ethics Committee of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. I don't at all speak for them. I'm a member of that committee. And I'm going to talk with you a little bit about some of the ethics opinions of that committee and how they do or do not further anti-discrimination with respect to fertility care. A reason why I think it's very important to look at what professional organizations are saying in their ethics opinions is that that's a way that practice can get really influenced and changed, because some of these organizations, in fact, can either themselves kick people out as members, so they have a kind of quasi-legal club, or the standards of professional organizations are sometimes cited even in licensing decisions. You know, you can gross immorality can cause you to lose your license as a physician and or as another kind of health provider, and often there is a look to the ethical standards of professions. So if what we're trying to do is to, as Sam Bagenstos said yesterday, look for levers of changing social norms that are not exactly constitutional law, but how do we change the norms that can ultimately become changes in constitutional law? One place to look, I think, is what professional organizations say and the practices that they encourage in their members. Another place to look that I, before I turn to that more specifically, that I just want to call your attention to is how people with disabilities get portrayed as parents in both bioethics writing and in more popular writing. And I'd like to call your attention to an article in last fall's New York Times by Sheila Black called Passing My Disability On to My Children. In that article, she not only, of course, raises to some extent the question of whether it was okay for her as someone with, she didn't know at the beginning was an X-linked condition that she could pass on, but she describes how she had to deal with the challenges of people looking at her and saying, you know, or questioning, is it okay to pass your disability? Well, why shouldn't it be? You know, she wants to turn the question around to portray, well, this is just, you know, people are, there are all kinds of differences in what the lives are like of our children, and there are all kinds of differences in what the lives are like of ourselves as parents. And there shouldn't be anything worse or globally bad, as Elizabeth Barnes in a recent book called The Minority Body says about disability. It's just one difference in parenting. Another really good portrayal of that sort, that's a counter to the presumption that people with disabilities are sort of specially problematic as parents is some work by Adam Curitan in the British Journal of Medical Ethics. If you're looking for anything that can, I'm trying to give you a little literature that might be helpful portrayals about, to counter the kinds of presumptions that people sometimes make about maybe there's a special sort of inadequacy about people with disabilities as parents. So that's just countering popular perceptions. What about what's going on in professional organizations? And I pick ASRM because they're the fertility docs. And you know, if you're interested in anti-discrimination norms and the development of anti-discrimination norms in the kind of care that people get, it's a good place to look. So there are three ethics opinions that are particularly relevant in this context. One of them is called child-rearing ability and the provision of fertility services. The other two are about high-risk pregnancies, people who are at elevated risk in a pregnancy, and about access to care, and particularly access to infertility treatment. So the first of these sticks in my craw in certain ways. The other two are much, much better. So I think they're models of the other two of what a professional organization might want to do and say. And I think the other one needs some work and hope at some point to be able to keep on contributing to that. So child-rearing ability and the provision of fertility services. Well, what's going on underneath this? A concern that it might be unethical if you're a fertility doc to provide services to somebody you think would be a clearly unfit parent. The paradigm case that people have in mind there is someone who has already had convictions of child abuse. But what about people who've had children, I'm talking about criminal convictions, but what about people who've had children removed? Well, that creeps in here too. And I'll just go back to what Jasmine said about, you know, we know that there are issues of disability discrimination in the whole child protection system. But part of what makes this opinion to me problematic is, I mean, on the one hand, it says something that's very right. It says that if you do decide that as a physician you think it would be unethical to provide care for someone, it has to be based on clear evidence. The well-substantiated, this is the actual language in the opinion, the well-substantiated inability to provide minimally adequate care that has been scrutinized, reviewed, talked about, not just your own personal beliefs about who might be a good parent or not. Here are the problems that then get singled out in the opinion. Persons who have a history of or current evidence of uncontrolled or untreated psychiatric illness, substance abuse, violent or criminal behavior, and child abuse, previous loss of parental rights, or ongoing partner abuse in their relationship. So they're sort of trying to get at, well-substantiated evidence of reasons why we might think somebody might not be a good parent. But then they go on, and they say something like this, and I'm going to quote, because of the importance of reproduction to persons, judgments to deny treatment should be made only when there is a strong and substantial basis for doing so. In making them, providers should pay special attention to treating equally persons with disabilities who request fertility services. Well, why not just say anyone? Many persons with disabilities are able and well qualified to rear children. Really? Why not anyone, right? And should not be disqualified from doing so merely because of their disability. And then a reference to the federal ADA. What bothers me about that is the implicit assumption that there might be a special problem about disability. That's why I started out with the descriptions of popular, which way is the presumption? Well, isn't the presumption that any of us are okay as parents? And then if there is clear evidence, well documented, of unfitness, whatever the reason, then it would be ethical for a provider to decline treatment. So I'm hoping that opinion gets, the language in that opinion gets shifted because of the defensive tone that it, as some of the popular writing takes about people with disabilities as parents. Because I think that it's really critical to try to change these norms from the ground up if there's going to be the kind of concerted change in social norms that will ultimately, we hope, bubble up to overruling Buck v. Bell. But let me now describe to you two much better opinions, okay? The first is about women of elevated risk. And there's some conditions that are associated with disabilities that mean that women might, in fact, be much riskier as patients. In fact, there are some conditions that pregnancy might be life-threatening in 50% of cases. So, well, maybe it's ethical for an infertility physician to say, I'm not going to treat you, or at a minimum, if I'm going to treat you, I'm only going to treat you with associated help from people who are specialists in minimizing risks associated with your condition. Now, the bad side in practice could be that once again disability creeps in. But the ASRM is very clear that this isn't about disability at all. It's about reasoned judgments about risks of mortality or morbidity from pregnancy being too high. Any of these assessments must be made without bias. The opinion says when declining to provide treatment, physicians must ensure that these decisions are made after careful consideration of the medical facts and without bias toward the woman or her partner. And it continues, such bias could include the physician's feelings towards the partner's age, patient's age, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, parenting unit, mental condition, or disability. So you can make a judgment that a pregnancy in a particular patient would be too risky for you to see it as appropriate, for you to want to provide care, but you got to make that decision in a way that is rooted in the medical risks and without bias. I like that. I think that kind of opinion is ethical. And finally, let me describe the opinion about disparities in access. The mention of disability in the opinion about disparities in access comes in exactly one place, the reference to the CRPD and the importance of reproduction, creation of a family as a basic human right. So there's no special mention of disability. There is a mention of disability as a human right, and the CRPD, I'm sorry, there's a mention of the right to form a family as a basic human right, and citation of the CRPD as support for that, as, you know, disability in turn helping to push and shape the human rights norms. There's also a recognition in that opinion that I think we all need to be aware of, which is that, as Kim said, the economic costs of infertility treatment are high. Many people don't have access to infertility treatment. The opinion urges members of ASRM to try as much as they can to change the payment structures with respect to infertility treatment. It doesn't go as far as saying you ought to do pro bono care, but it says you should be advocating for increased access to care, and it calls attention to the fact that there are significant disparities in access to care. The one disparity that I would raise for this group is that most state Medicaid programs don't cover infertility treatment. And, of course, many people with disabilities are more likely to have Medicaid rather than employer-provided insurance as their source of insurance funding. So there are a lot of disparities in access. Okay, so let me just wrap up by saying that I think if we're looking at creating norm changes all the way down, one of the things we really need to look carefully at is how people get portrayed as parents and how they get thought about as parents in the sorts of statements that are made from within the medical profession, ethics advisory opinions, and other guidance to practicing physicians as another way of working to change norms from the bottom up so that we ultimately get to the very top. Thanks.
Thank you, and thanks to all of you in the panel here on this topic. What you have said makes me think I should ask you some questions or make you a speech, but instead of doing that, let's hear from the members of the audience. Please tell me your name, and we'll go forward. Questions?
Yes, hi.
Oh, good, and what's your name?
Will Geddes.
Go for it.
Thank you. I had an observation from Ms. Harris's presentation. She raised two points that I thought were quite interesting. One was that the low-hanging fruit type cases would be the fundamental right cases of parental termination. And the second point that struck me was that the courts are inherently wanting to zero out risk for disabled people. And the reason why these two comments interested me is I have a case where I've observed that the court, as for the low-hanging fruit theory that a fundamental right might be a strategic place to start to push back and to change the culture of the courts, I found that it's especially problematic in parental termination rights where there is a protective custody issue, because the court simply hides behind the best interest of the child and the safety of the child. And of course, the implication is, well, there's risk in any parenting, and it's inappropriate for the court to assume that a disabled or blind parent can't be given the right to accept those risks like anyone else. So I thought maybe she could comment on that. Thank you.
Okay.
Dr. Bauer, do you want to take the questions altogether?
I wish to consult with the members of the panel on the topic. I ordinarily would take them one at a time, but yesterday we had a different scenario where we had all the questions and then all the answers. The panel members get to decide. Which way do you want to do it?
We've polled the panel, and I think we'll take the questions.
All the questions first. Okay, who's up next?
So, hi, this is two questions for Jasmine. The first
Tell us your name.
Rabia Belt at Stanford Law School.
Right, right.
So it seems as if in terms of the spectrum of sexual practices for folks with IDDD that you have healthy sexual interactions, you have mistakes, and then you have problematic sexual behavior, including sexual assault. And in your database of the sexual assault cases, given that most of the perpetrators, you said, are caretakers, family friends, people of authority, things like that, regardless of what the procedural defects are, I wonder how those relationships could veer into the mistake healthy sexual behavior category and not be in the problematic sexual mm-hmm. category. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that it seems like you propose doing sort of an ex ante determination of whether or not a person is capable of sexual consent. So I wonder if that presumes that that determination is a static one, and if not, then how are we going to do those determinations over the course of the person's life?
Okay, and then we have a third person?
And a fourth.
And a fourth, yeah. Go ahead, number three. Who are you?
Yes, good morning. Daniel Van Sant. I'm with Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid. So I have a question for the panel generally, but specifically I'd like to hear from Professor Harris. So I work on a grant and exclusively provide services to victims and survivors of sexual assault, and because of personal interest, try to take a lot of our disability-centric cases. And so one of the tensions that I keep running into, specifically with protective orders and family law with individuals with intellectual disabilities who are survivors, is sort of this forest of the trees tension of that these cases generally are very hard to win. And so sometimes you feel like you have to leverage the disability sympathy or sort of play that card to get safety and protection for that individual survivor, but you feel like you're sacrificing the overall advancement of the movement. And so I just was wondering if someone could comment on navigating those tensions and any ways that you see that we could address that.
Great question.
Okay, Sharon?
Thanks, Sharon Krever-Weisbaum. One of my most interesting cases that I probably ever handled was on behalf of an individual with an intellectual disability who wanted to get married. And although and immediately her family filed a guardianship petition. And although I shouldn't have had the burden of proof, really, it quickly turned into it was my burden to convince the court that. And it was all about sex. That's the focus. Everybody's focus was, you know, her vulnerability and why did this man who did not have any intellectual disability, why was he interested? But it became my burden. I mean, that's what they were looking for, the judge, of, you know, why, the whole why, and did she have capacity? And I did litigate that case like that, meaning I got my expert. And we actually beat that guardianship, and they ended up getting married. But I wondered if you would have litigated it differently, or how would you have done it procedurally? I mean, I did kind of take it on as my burden, but I'm not sure. I mean, I didn't think I could win otherwise, but wondered. Thanks.
Okay. Professors?
Go for it, Jasmine.
Jasmine's going to start.
I'm going to start. You all have really wonderful questions. So let's see if I can group them together. The issue of risk in these types of cases, I think the awareness, so going to your first question about risk and zeroing out risk, I think having that awareness that judges are seeing this through the lens of risk aversion across the board, not just in disability, but particularly in disability, helps in terms of strategies, and we'll talk a little bit about how do you negotiate these difficult positions of advancing the movement versus winning your case. I mean, these are really tough questions. So I'm exploring this concept of risk in particular in the context of family law and disability and intellectual disability. And so I'm exploring again, what are the stakes and how do we formulate a risk calculus that properly includes the benefits that are at stake, right? So again, the dignity concept, the dignity of risk, the ability to over time, it's experiential education for the person so that they understand the world and they're able to experience it. So we're basically positioning people with IDDD in a terrible position where we're saying, we're not gonna give you sex education, we're not gonna provide you with the tools necessary for you to meet this legal standard. Sound familiar? Does it sound like voting in the Jim Crow era in some respects? I mean, this is what, it's not to that degree, but what I'm saying is it's the same concept. We're not providing people with ID and DD the tools to actually meet these onerous legal standards. Okay, so that's the first point. Robbie, you raised two questions. I'm going to take the second first, which is this idea of ex-ante determinations. It's certainly not my intent to suggest that that's the best way to do it. I'm simply saying that that is one way that people might think about it. And certainly if we had that, it would be a really difficult task. Why? For the reason you said, that legal capacity, as I understand it, and many people share this view, that legal capacity is something that is fluctuating and depends on a particular moment in time and a particular decision to be had. And so we should be looking at it through that lens in terms of complexity. And so I think an ex-ante determination is not my preferred method. What I'm suggesting is that is one area that scholars have said we should think about this, perhaps in the context of general guardianship proceedings where you're trying to move from a plenary guardianship to a limited guardianship and specifically say this person retains these rights as a positive matter. So that's on that point. I'm going to try to go very quickly on this. Healthy mistakes and sexual assault. How do we move from one to the other? So as I understand your question, Robbie, and please clarify if I'm not getting it correctly, it's how do we move from the region of sexual assault where there is problematic behavior and where there are cases of manipulation and abuse and clear force and other aspects that we're not comfortable with to looking at the ability to have a healthy relationship and to make mistakes. So I see that more. Is that your question?
Well, I just wanted to give a sort of who the perpetrators are. How can you recharacterize what happens as either mistakes or healthy sexual behavior, even given the procedural defects?
So very quickly, because I know other folks want to respond to other questions, but the problem here, and we can talk about this, is the conception of mens rea for the defendant, that's a particularly complex matter. So how is a defendant to know or should have known that the person had a disability? We're asking them to also make leaps of faith. I'm not up here trying to defend or offer potential defenses to defendants or potential perpetrators to abuse people with disabilities. Rather, what I'm trying to do is to suggest that in this context that we understand the rights of people with intellectual disabilities in the realm of sexuality to be different. and okay, our norms are different. Okay.
Now, we are about out of time here, and let's give the other panel members a shot at it before we call it a day.
So I want to just say briefly that there's some very interesting material about individuals as informed consent in some of the ethics opinions where the worries, this is informed consent to fertility treatment, where the worries are about things like whether somebody would be coerced. And I think that you can take some of the discussions about what is really required for informed consent from the, we're assuming that there's somebody here who is competent to some of the other contexts that Jasmine is talking about. And I would also say that I think where risk analysis is happening, it's most troubling in the context of risks to others rather than risks to self. A lot of the discussion in bioethics is entirely happy to think through the complex questions of, sure, it's fine for people to take risks for themselves as long as they know what they're doing. And how we can translate some of that, as long as they know what they're doing, into the whole context of risks to others is also really worth thinking about.
Kimberly?
So I'm just going to take 30 seconds to make a plug for this being a space where there's lots of opportunity for coalition building, in particular because as a person who teaches family law, as I often say to my students, family courts are frequently lawless places, right? The kinds of things that go on there are deeply, deeply troubling, and there are so many different communities of people and activists who are working on these issues, so it's a really great place for interests to coincide.